Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. Program complete. Enter when ready.
The curtain of night is drawn back. The telescopes are trained. The domes are open. The audience is set. Now, step into the event horizon.
Good evening. I should say good evening, everyone. And welcome to the Event Horizon here on Astronomy.fm Radio. I'm your host, Marty Coons, with my co-host.
Good evening, everybody. It's Nick Evets, KC2VWR, 2 Echo Zero, Lima Uniform November.
Again, Friday evening, October the 28th, 2016, also at 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, also known as October the 29th, Saturday morning at 1 o'clock in the morning, Universal Time. So, well, for at least another week or so, we'll have Universal Time. I think it's next weekend. We're back on Standard Time.
Well, my computer's going to Universal Time all the time. And in the UK, they do it Saturday night, Sunday morning.
Ah, well, good for your computer.
Well, I'm an astronomer. I can't live on local time. Everything in the astronomical world's on universal time.
Not dinner time.
But dinner time's on universal time. It's 12 noon. Eh.
Yeah. So our show before Halloween here in the U.S., which would be on the 31st Monday evening, so this is as close as we get. We're not going to do anything too scary, I think. I did a scary portion of a scary show for Space Prayer. It went last Wednesday. Just regular stuff. Oh, by the way, an asteroid's going to crash into the Earth Monday.
Dream on, Marty. Actually, speaking of doomed, we're doomed. There's been an update on the status of Juno. Juno, okay. As most people know, just before the second perigee mission, went into safe mode. Well, the onboard computer detected an anomaly wrapped in an enigma and says, I'm shutting down. Well, it shut down all the science instruments, and it is still currently in safe mode. I'm going to put a link into the chat room, okay, for later, everybody, because you're too busy listening to us, okay, right now. So, this is the link to the YouTube about it. Now, Aquifer User says it's now finally reawakened. Good. In that case, NASA need to update one of their news briefings because they ain't doing it that quick at the minute. But that's good news that Juno has finally awoke, and yes, we can now get on with the science. Yes, we had a spectacular perigee 1 pass, and of course, we were looking forward to the second pass and some even more science. And you know what? If you watch the video, you will see how some of the instruments actually work on Jupiter, how they're actually seeing down below the surface, well, the surface to us, cloud layer and piercing the veil, so to speak, which is kind of apt with Halloween on Monday.
It is. So, like a stake through the heart.
Not really. It's like a carving knife taking a piece of cake.
There you go.
But the thing is, this is going to be the whole mission is going to be some brilliant science, because we really don't know what is, the core of Jupiter. Is it a massive diamond like we were told in 2010? Or is it a condensed core of metallic hydrogen? We just don't know. But something is causing heat, and it is that heat which is causing and fueling the Great Red Spot, the biggest storm in the solar system, really. So that we'll be able to get to see, and we'll be able to get to see what is hopefully causing it eventually. So, touching wood, well, I'm touching a nice big piece of pine wood, actually. Everything's now going to run fairly well, and we're going to get some splendid science back. But as I say, it must have been a very short turnaround for them changing from Ober and safe mode to, oh, we've woke it up again. But it's good news. It just shows you what you can do with a bit of ingenuity.
Yes, indeed. Oh, yeah. So I really should mention our chat room. Yes, come on over to the chat room, astronomy.fm with a /, and then type the word chat. You get to the login page. And come on and join us. We're reading the chat room as we're speaking, so you have questions for us.
Well,
announce them on air.
Very true, because there are some new storms being seen budging near the poles. Nothing like the huge hexagonal one Saturn's got, but we are still seeing a new facet of Jupiter. So we have everything to wait for. Yeah, I know, no hexagons. Well, you can't have everything. Saturn's got to have something that's spectacular. It's got the rings, it's got the hexagons. At both poles, as I recollect. So, we should have some good fun there.
That's right.
Let's just say hello to Glenn, to Black Projects, Aqua for You, Optronics, in the Quiet Wood. Nice to see you all in the chat room. Hopefully Starstorm will be joining us shortly. But as I say, it's going to be a fun, and it is good news that they woke Juno up. It would have been a really sad demise if they couldn't.
Just to recap, Juno is the space probe that is orbiting around Jupiter for about 30 missions. It can last just 1 year or two, something like that. Goes around every few weeks. It gets in real close and then swings way back out again. It's going over the poles of Jupiter, so definitely giving us better views and views of things we have never seen before on Jupiter, like good views of the polar regions of Jupiter itself. Go ahead.
Nice thing is, it's going to hopefully advance our knowledge of the solar system.
Yes, indeed. Well, obviously, it's going to do that.
Nothing is ever obvious. let's face it. Schiaparelli.
Yes, Schiaparelli.
And it became a Kaplutnik. The Russian hoodoo struck again, folks.
Well, now, in all fairness, it was like a temporary piece of test equipment. It had batteries, didn't have any other long-lasting power source, did not have solar panels to recharge those batteries or anything like that. It was a couple of experiments, weather experiments, just to last for a few days, and mostly was to send out a signal that the orbiter would actually be able to detect, just to confirm that its receivers are working properly. It's going to last a few days, and then it was definitely going to be Kaplutnik, but that was on purpose. I don't think they should have actually named this. It's more of a, not a lander with a long-term mission or even any potential long-term mission. It was a piece of test equipment. Well, kind of like a voltmeter you have on your desk. You wouldn't name that, would you? It was like well, they should just called it, you know, test equipment.
I don't name my test equipment. I don't name my radios. I may occasionally name my cars if I find they have a distinct personality. Uh-huh. But they're not test equipment, though.
No. Yeah, so I think they should just given it a designation, because it was just going to use it, throw it away.
Well, let's face it. Schiaparelli was the man who gave us the canals of Mars.
Exactly.
And I think we threw that all away, haven't we?
Yeah, I know. I think a longer-lasting probe would have been much more appropriate.
Well, to be honest, it should have been a combination of solar and the nuclear strap, the Snap 90 batteries that have done so well on earlier missions and forays into the further edges of the solar system. To be honest, I felt that they shortchanged Phoenix as well. Because it's purely dependent on solar. If they get covered up by sand, they have to wait for the next storm to come along and blow it off.
Yeah.
So give it an atomic power pack, and you're cooking gas.
Definitely a chance for a extended mission. With an atomic power pack, you are not cooking with gas.
Well, let's face it. Voyager probes, Pioneer, are all using radioactive isotopes to create electric power.
Yes.
For the instruments. Yep. Those power packs are still working away nicely. They're powering the probe, and they are actually still talking to home. They are still calling home. We know where they are. We can detect a very faint signal. In some cases, we are still getting very useful scientific information from them.
Yep. Would have been a risk to put that on a potentially future habitable planet, though, I think, and would have contaminated area. Not like we haven't contaminated areas with radioactivity on this planet. Lesson learned, don't contaminate another planet you plan on landing on sometime in the future, maybe even colonizing.
Well, theoretically, Mars is already contaminated with radiation anyway. It has no magnetic field, and when a solar storm kicks off, it gets irradiated.
Well, there's a difference between an external source of radiation and a putting one there on purpose on the surface.
So, but seriously, the thing is, if you're going to send a mission to Mars, even a test bed, you really should consider giving it a really good power supply.
Yes.
Now, yeah, I know that Spirit and Oppy are still going strong. However, they do occasionally get sanded up a bit, and they have to shut down and conserve power at least until the next decent windstorm clears them off. Well, maybe
opportunity and curiosity. I think Spirit's one that's got stuck in the sand.
Yeah, but the thing is, it's still giving us data. Mm-hmm. We're still talking to it. It's still doing science in some respects. It's now a weather station in a particular point, which is brilliant. Because you know what? If we are going to go to Mars, if we are going to colonize it, we need to start accruing meteorological data.
Yes.
And that is exactly what it's doing. All right. Sadly, it can't explore. And it can do other things. It can be a perfect opportunity to say we can have a spot weather station. We can see what's going on. Perfect.
Hopefully someday soon we'll put somebody at least in an orbit around Mars temporarily and then shoot them back. I'd be happy with that.
Yeah, that's one way to do it. That is kind of going back to the Apollo, early Apollo missions,
yep.
Where we did some Earth orbits, then we moved and did a lunar orbit, then we did some more rendezvous work with the LEM and the command module, and then we really kicked off and went to the moon and landed.
Yep.
It was a shame. I wonder what happened if the crew that was testing the lunar module in lunar orbit had actually accidentally touched down. I don't think Neil and Buzz would have been very happy. But you know what? Sometimes you never know. However, having said that, maybe when we get to Mars and we actually have our forward base there, maybe we should send a few techs out and reactivate and perhaps update some of the equipment we've got there. Okay, we know that the Viking probes, they've done their job, really. But the rovers could be perhaps updated and could be given better power supplies and then be kicked off again in a new direction.
Yep.
Perfect use. Why just have it sit there?
It'll still be going slow, though. Real slow. They need faster motors, but we could do bigger, yeah. Bigger batteries and faster motors.
Well, it's been pointed out quite correctly by Black Projects in the chat room. Apollo 10 was short on fuel, so they could not have landed and gotten back off. However, it would have been a nice thought, wouldn't it?
That's what I was wondering, if they had enough fuel to land, but didn't fill the tanks for the launcher.
Because the thing with the LEM engine, the ascent stage, it's a hypergolic one use. One chance, and if it blows it, you're finished.
Yep.
Still interesting technology, and who knows, maybe they'll bring back something like the LEM for short local work around the moon. Two guys and a crew going out surveying using a LEM-style lander. Who knows?
There we go. Black Project was
the descent engine was
short on fuel. Okay.
But it's just a nice thought, isn't it, what they could have possibly done? I suppose they would have got a royal telling off from Chris Kraft if they had gone in ahead of without permission. But
did it safe and was successful.
That was the important thing. But it would have been interesting to see what would happen if 10 had been the first lunar landing mission, mm-hmm. even by accident.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not by accident, by.
Hey guys, do we really want to let another crew get there first?
Sort of top gunning, buzzing the tower type of accident, huh?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So we had a slight problem. We accidentally touched down, guys, but we'll be back in orbit in a few minutes.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, Neil, we did it before you.
Oops.
One of those things. Maybe we'll never know since history took a different direction. But it's fun to think about it and to maybe speculate.
A couple of rocks heading our way for October the 31st. We've got one rock. It's about 40 feet in diameter. It's going to be only 1.3 lunar diameter, so that puts it somewhere around 300,000 miles away from us. 40-foot rock, not too bad. A couple more that are going to be a little bit more than a million and a quarter miles away from us, but they're going to be bigger at about 75 feet in diameter. So nothing really big, really close, but definitely detecting some stuff kind of heading our way for October the 31st. Perfect for Halloween, huh? Would you call that a near miss, 300,000 miles? Slightly farther out than the moon itself. Anybody see any of that observer, aurora that's been going on for the past couple of days? The sun's had a coronal hole in it. It means the outer atmosphere of the sun has been absent, allowing extra photons and energized particles from the surface of the sun, quote-unquote surface, to head out into space and get captured by our magnetic field and light up our atmosphere. So extreme polar observers were getting some pretty nice aurora photographs and images lately. So
I have just been told officially that Spirit was switched off, so it couldn't be used as a weather station. Oh, well, that's a shame.
I kind of had that feeling, but had to look it up. Thanks. Appreciate that. That's what our chat room's for. People can also look up stuff while we're off on different subjects, too. NASA and ESA have been quite busy. Got some astronauts coming back from the International Space Station.
And there's two going off soon as well.
Yes, about a week, November 11th. Another mission's going to be heading back to the space station. Let's go to the ones that are coming back. So I got this from the NASA space station. It's Expedition 49 crew members, which includes Anatoly Avanishin of the Russian space agency Roscosmos, flight engineer Kate Rubens of NASA, and Takuya Onishi of the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency will be heading back to Earth real soon. I think, is it like tomorrow or something like that, if I'm not mistaken?
Yes, they're set to depart on the 29th. Now, three of the crew members, it includes radio amateurs KG5FYJ and KF5LKS. They're departing the station on the 29th.
Yep.
They should land in Kazakhstan at about 0359 UTC on Sunday. Now, once the Soyuz undocks, Expedition 50 will begin aboard the ISS under the command of NASA astronaut Shane Kimbrough, who is KE5HOD. And, of course, two more radio amateurs, KC5ZTD and KG5FYG, are scheduled on the launch from Kazakhstan in November.
That's astronauts Thomas Pesquet from the ESA, NASA astronauts Peggy Whitson, and Roscosmos commander Oleg Novitsky would be the ones heading up to the space station about the second week of November. I think the launch is tentatively scheduled for November 11th, as I said just before.
Yeah, the American ham radio gear in aboard the ISS is actually broken at the moment. It's actually the oldest piece of ham radio gear in space right now. So all amateur radio in schools and space is being handled by the Russian radio, the unit in the Russian module. And, of course, the American radio is a walkie-talkie, so a WT. So it hasn't done too bad, considering it's probably taking a heck of a lot of knocks in zero-G during its time up there. So still doing pretty good. And, of course, it being an HT, it is, of course, very convenient just to stuff in the pocket.
Now, I thought the biggest space ham was Captain Kirk, actually.
No, I heard it was Jean-Luc Picard.
Argue that one.
Well, we could argue that one all night, Marty.
Yep. Check out NASA TV for the return and the launches. So you can actually watch those live.
Yeah, the nicest thing that there is about NASA and ESA. And to some degree, Roscosmos too, because the launches are now being carried live, and the Russians do transmit the landings live as well. So it's one of those lovely things that you actually get a chance to see what is going on and to follow the whole thing from start to finish.
Yep. Two of my top bookmarks are the NASA website and the ESA website for what's happening in space.
Well, they're also available on Livestream. They have their own accounts as well. Okay. So if you have a Livestream account, bookmark them, because in a lot of cases, you will actually, if you favorite them, then you will start getting emails. Now, I still have a few friends at STEC, so I quite often get a heads up and told to tune in for events like the separation of the Schiaparelli test module from ExoMars. But to be honest, if you want to get see these events, favorite it, and then you'll get an email sent to your email account that's for that particular viewer. It's the best way to keep ahead of what's going on.
Let's do a little bit of review on the Mars mission that failed. Again, the recent Mars mission, which was... Who was that? That was the ESA, right?
That was a European Space Agency and Roscoff collaboration. NASA chickened out. This is the one that NASA pulled out of at the last minute, leaving the whole thing without a launch facility. And the Russians stepped in and offered, I think it was one of their proton launchers, because they actually got more and more active in the whole mission. Yeah, they bailed at 9 months. They had signed agreements, they had said they would give X amount of money, and the money they were providing was very important to the whole project. If Roscoff hadn't stepped in, ExoMars was actually going to have to be stopped, because there just wasn't suddenly the money there that was supposed to have been there. And I think this is going to be a problem for NASA in the future, because there's going to be the trust issue. Are you going to bail at 9 months and then pull all your money out of the kitty suddenly without telling anybody?
Kind of like a boyfriend with a pregnant girlfriend.
I wouldn't know about that. But to be honest, I have to say this. I honestly think if NASA had stayed in the mission, the technology demonstrator may have actually succeeded. There is for some reason, Russian-launched landers are cursed with Mars.
Well, we'll find out when if they can analyze its last signals. There's a two-part mission on ExoMars. One was an orbiter for checking trace gases as it goes around orbit in above Mars, and then there was a lander. As I said, it was going to do a little bit of weather study and transmit some signals. This is all part of a 2020 Michigan mission. That's going to combine some other equipment together. So the lander failed. The idea was that the lander would separate from the orbiter, go down, heat shield first. After the heat shield, parachute. After parachute, it would separate from the parachute. Engines would kick in and lower it all the way down to the surface on engines, cut out about 6 feet from the surface, and just basically kind of a soft thud on the surface from 6 feet. So not too bad at all, but something failed.
Well, from what I heard...
Okay.
Basically what really happened was they were getting telemetry.
Yes.
That the drogue had popped and was there. Parachutes had deployed.
Yes.
Then there was 90 seconds of thrust telemetry, and then everything cut out.
So they don't know if the parachute popped open too soon and then separated too soon, or if the engines started and misread the altitude or ran out of fuel. So somewhere the signals got crossed, software glitched, and obviously the engines cut off at too high of an altitude, and instead of just thudding on the surface, it splattered. And possibly cause a little bit of explosion, so which indicates maybe there was probably some fuel left in the engines, which ignited on impact. It looks like a pretty charred area.
It's a new crater. So they're looking at the front heat shield is 10 meters across. From the picture from MRO, it was a fairly cataclysmic impact.
Yes.
It went in at supersonic speeds pretty much. Kabang.
So hopefully they'll figure out what went wrong and figure out if that can be corrected, a correctable error, or it was just a unusual glitch, or it's going to need a backup, or what went wrong with the backup system. Usually these things have a backup system. So if there's any software doubts, you know, there would be another program that would take over and keep things from going wrong. But was it mechanical? You know, did a mechanism cut loose?
Optronics has a question for us.
Said what?
Optronics has a question.
All right.
What is the question?
What is your question, Optronics? So good thing there were not astronauts getting ready to land on Mars inside that thing.
To be honest, Marty, if it had been a manned mission, I tend to think it would have probably been very much done the same way as Apollo 11, a human at the controls. That way you can judge things better, even if you have your radar altimeter go out.
Yes,
that's what happened.
Depending on what the error is, some errors are not human correctable. You run out of fuel.
Yeah. But I don't think that was the real. I don't think that was the problem. I think something was mistimed, and that put everything else off.
All right, we got a. What kind of rocket will bring the astronauts back to Earth from Mars? I'm thinking it's something along the lines of, is it SpaceX that brings a rocket back down to Earth?
I think from all the information I've seen, they're looking to use the Orion system to travel to Mars and to the asteroid belt.
Well, I'm talking about what kind of rocket will bring astronauts back. Basically, you're going to have almost a full-size rocket land on the surface of Mars. Mars' gravity is only one-half that of Earth, so it still takes quite a large rocket to get off the surface of Mars. For instance, the moon, the gravity is one-sixth, so obviously it was pretty easy to take off in a much smaller launch vehicle, but Mars is going to take one almost as big as it takes to get off the Earth.
Well, to be honest, there's been a few designs, and some of the designs I've seen were actually tested long after Apollo. We were talking about a command capsule stroke lander. So you'll have something set along the lines of the LEM, but maybe with the Orion capsule on top. So you would have a engine and a fuel tank for your liftoff. So
if that can be big enough, I don't know. That's a lot of stuff to lift off. You're going to need a pretty big rocket with a lot of fuel.
But the thing is, Marty,
Mars.
If you take everybody still thinks about the Zubrin idea, sending all your equipment ahead of you. You've got a piece of equipment that's making fuel already for you. So all you've got to do is refuel.
Yeah, but you have to have a big enough fuel tank, too. So you can't have something like, you know, a third stage of a rocket. You can have it land, but you can't have it lift because you just can't put enough fuel into it.
But you don't need to lift the whole thing. You can...
Yeah, lift the whole capsule.
You got to lift the capsule, yes, but you don't need to...
And itself and its fuel.
But you don't have to have something where you're lifting a whole state, a stage and a half. So you could have a spacecraft that's the lander that is, when it comes to liftoff from Mars, leaves the actual feet behind. That's what that was one of the ideas I've heard expressed. So basically, you've got your capsule, you've got your lander section. Your lander section then becomes your launch facility to send the crewed part back into orbit.
I'm thinking it's going to have to be something along the lines of a SpaceX, where the whole first stage goes up and comes back down. And as you talked about before, building stuff in space, I'm thinking that what they'll have to do is put something like a SpaceX first stage in orbit around the Earth, fuel it in orbit, send it on its way to Mars so it could actually land and then lift off and then come back. Maybe they'll have to put fuel in orbit around Mars, take that fuel on, and then send it back to the Earth. I think it's something along those lines. I think it's going to have to be a bigger rocket than you're thinking of. Mars has got a lot of gravity at half that of Earth.
The nice thing is, Marty, we don't have to send the spacecraft in one piece. You could actually have part of the spacecraft there waiting for you. When you get to Mars, when you finish your Mars cruise in, say, Orion, you dock, you have a lander and return vehicle waiting for you, fully fueled. So you're not dependent on carrying the fuel with you from Earth. So, and there was a BBC docudrama called Voyage to the Planets. In this, the spacecraft Pegasus was touring the solar system. Now, they're using exactly the same techniques as used by Voyager. They use gravity assists, but strategic parts of the solar system, they have hydrogen fuel waiting for them. So basically, they get to Mars, they get to Jupiter and to Saturn, and there is fuel standing by in orbit waiting for them to transfer it for the next stage of the journey.
Question we got in our chat room here, what kind of fuel? Well, the only kind of fuel you could actually make on Mars, since there's no fossil fuels there, would be hydrogen and oxygen, which can be made from water. So if they can find a supply of water using electricity to like maybe a solar panel to break it down, or a nuclear reactor to break it down into hydrogen and oxygen, separate it out, then that would be your fuel. That would be really the only fuel you would be able to make on Mars, be out of water.
Well, that in itself is a major step forward, because when the Mars explorers are no longer dependent on taking everything with them. Right. So you send a refinery to Mars first, it soft lands, or maybe you send two to be on the safe side.
Refinery?
Refinery, yeah, because you're gonna create your fuel on the surface. You're gonna refine it.
You can only refine like fossil fuels.
Yeah, but you know what I'm talking about. It's sending a piece of equipment that is gonna take from the Martian atmosphere the materials to create the rocket fuel to leave Mars and start the journey home. Now, thank you very much. Thanks, BP. That's what I'm talking about. Now, again, This is science fiction, but they planned a meticulous scientific journey through the solar system, creating a spacecraft which is feasible. We know that nuclear engines, hydrogen powered engines, are possible. We can do it, and it is perfectly safe for us to use them in space. Particularly once we get clear of the Earth's magnetic field, there is no risk to the planet. And in the case of the water ice, as Aquifer points out, we could use electrolysis.
Yes, that's what I was talking about, making hydrogen and oxygen.
So your piece of your equipment does all the work on Mars. As you're arriving, you have a fuel supply waiting for you. So you have the option then to refuel on the planet's surface and then leave to come home. You rendezvous back in space for the return trip. Now, Lockheed have said Orion is capable of extended journeys as far as the asteroid belt and back, manned. So being the main part of the main craft to get to Mars is not beyond its capabilities.
Right.
And it is bigger. I think it's 4 or 5 times bigger than the original Apollo Command capsules, and it's also set out for a crew of 5, mm-hmm. which was kind of what they did with the Saturn 1Bs that were designated rescue rockets for Skylab. They had modified, they stripped out everything that wasn't needed from the command module and capsules, put in 5 seats so you could send 2 guys up to bring the 3 guys on Skylab home. As they set it as a lifeboat. And that is exactly what capability they want Orion to have, looking at all the information that's been put out so far. So, yes, we do have the capability. Yes, we've got the radiation issues, I know, but we still have something that could carry a crew to Mars. They might need a bigger spacecraft, granted, because they're probably going to want to move around a fair bit to keep themselves in trim. They're going to want to grow their own food on the way. They can recycle urine for water, and they can, that way it cuts back on the amount of water they have to ship up. Or you can make your water in space, in orbit, in tanks, by sparking hydrogen and oxygen together. So you can create your water supply there as well.
I wonder what's more efficient, methane or hydrogen as a fuel?
Well, in space, if you're traveling in space, particularly if you're on a very long duration trip, you could look at using a Bussard ramjet. Now, admittedly, in order for it to be more to be efficient, you need to accelerate to quite close to the speed of light. I think they said, 75.75 light speed? But once you get up to high speeds and you're traveling through the solar system, there is hydrogen to feed the reactors of a Bussard ramjet. So you're literally gathering your fuel as you travel. But I tend to think they are going to be used more perhaps for trips to beyond the solar system, where once they get into interstellar space, it will be a lot easier to collect. But there are ways to do it. The only problem we have right now is the fact that the 1963 Outer Space Test Ban Treaty prohibits nuclear engines, because in a lot of cases the technology they're using is controlled explosions, controlled detonation, and that's illegal in space. You can't test nuclear weapons in space, and it could be said that your engine is actually a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, technically, sort of.
Yeah, maybe. But the treaty doesn't see technicalities. They will see that perhaps NASA, Roscoff, and ESA are putting a whacking great nuclear weapon into space, and they're going to detonate it to move their spacecraft, which means the rest of the world will be up in arms, and there'll be harried arguments in the UN about European Space Agency, Roscoff, and NASA being criminals for the use of nuclear weapons in space. I think it's getting to the point where we really have to re-examine the treaty, not individually as countries, but perhaps internationally. We need to sit down and see what we can do to change, reword the treaty to allow us to use this technology for peaceful space travel.
Oh, Nick, yeah. We have to report into the ship to make sure everything's okay here on the surface.
Yep, just 1 second, I'm just going to report in. Landing party to Miranda, all present and correct.
You are listening to the Event Horizon here on astronomy.fm radio.
And welcome Starstorm to the chat room. She's just joined us.
It is October the 28th, 2016. I've got 9:39 in the evening Eastern Daylight Time here for North America, also known as October the 29th. At 1:39 Universal Time. So you're still listening to us live. We have another 20 minutes or so to go in our program, so stick around. Come on and join us in our astronomy.fm chat room. You go to the homepage and just click on the button or type in astronomy.fm/chat. That'll get you to log in, and be glad to have you here. Coming up, of course, we've got more programming, another 3 hours worth of program, and we'll repeat the whole four-hour block every 4 hours for the next 24 hours, in case you missed part of the program. So stick around for more programming after this. Yes.
Please do go to the show notes, because if you're listening after the show's finished, all the links and some of the interesting comments will be there. So they're there for you to see and enjoy.
There you go. Don't forget, of course, that donate button on our homepage. That keeps us on the air, because we do have to pay for bandwidth. Well, so that's your generous contributions that keeps us on the air, keeps the world a little bit more intelligent. You can't fix stupid, but you can give it a shot by keeping these science types of programs on the air. So it's all up to you, folks. Keep us going by donating to astronomy.fm. We're all a volunteer organization. We don't make any profit on this. We don't get paid for this. So
we do it for the love of the job.
Exactly. Kind of like joining your astronomy club. So consider us part of your astronomy club if you want to do it that way.
In fact, I have just been asked to test gravity.
You've been asked to test gravity?
Yes.
That could be bad.
Oh, no, that's simple.
Well,
I've been told to wait a minute.
Test gravity by, jumping out of a very high airplane, that's not a good thing.
No, the only time you're going to test gravity that way is if you've got a parachute and your aircraft's disintegrating.
Well, don't need a parachute to test gravity.
I have the perfect instrument to test gravity.
All right, what is it? You have a graviton detector?
Yeah, gravity's working fine. I'm taking a leaf out of the Fourth Doctor's book. I've just tested it with my yo-yo.
My yo-yo.
Starstorm's yo-yo.
There you go.
And by the way, Aqua Snow Hopes, yesterday it was snowing here in upstate New York, so I've got snow on the brain.
It's gone.
It is gone.
I've got an interesting interesting link from Hubble Space Telescope. This is actually through SciTech Daily. Check this out. Let me put it into our chat room here. It's about Hubble imaging of the Crab Nebula. None of these I've seen before. Huge extended amount of gas, but there's a video of basically pulsations in the gas right next to the core of the Crab Nebula. You can actually see ripples going through the gas in this video. Check it out. It's really cool.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
I've never seen this. Even though this was taken, sequence was taken in 2005, I'd never seen it before, actually watching the gases in the Crab Nebula ripple through space. That's pretty cool.
Now, there's another story going on. It's from 2015, forget it. I'm actually surfing through SKARN Telescope as we chat, so to pull up some interesting stuff. So we'll see what else I can pull up.
All right, I got another one here. Triple protostar. Let me put this into our chat room here. Protostar is basically a pre-star. We can detect gas clumping together before nuclear reactions are occurring, or maybe just right about that time. So basically there's bright clumps of knots of gas in a rotating gas cloud. Generally, it needs infrared telescopes to be able to actually see this, because we can't look through gas with visible light. So you have to use infrared light to detect the heat there. And this is a spiraling gas cloud with three knots in it. So that would mean that basically three stars are kind of forming inside of this gas cloud. Again, first time this was taken with a not infrared, this is taken with a radio telescope system called ALMA, Altacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array. So with radio telescopes, they're using to detect these gas, the gas condensing into brand new stars. It's actually pretty cool.
Now, also coming up this in November, which is only a few days away.
It is.
So the last month you're going to have chance to see Saturn. It is low down in the west after sunset, and early in the month you'll find it to the right of brilliant Venus. Now, and eventually it'll be by November's end, Saturn will be gone. Yes. Venus, however, is getting dramatically obvious and getting higher in the evening sky with each passing evening, and that will be with us all winter long. I love the spelling mistakes sometimes here.
So we're getting a conjunction of Venus and Saturn within the next few days.
And the moon.
And the moon coming in
there
too.
So November the 2nd, you're going to have the waning crescent moon, but directly below will be Saturn. And to one side will be Venus.
Waxing. It's got to be waxing. It's got to be waxing because it's in the evening sky.
Yep.
November 2nd. Yeah, because the 31st-ish or so is the new moon. So it has to be a waxing crescent getting brighter.
You know what the nicest thing about the winter skies is?
Winter in the Northern Hemisphere, what is that?
Orion,
yes, indeed.
You've got the belt. You've got the belt of Orion. You've got the some of the most beautiful objects in the universe there. And you have, of course, the trapezium.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is one of my favorite things I love to image. Because what I'm trying to do there, I'm trying to actually get the trapezium where it's individual stars and not just a big white blob.
Yes. The trapezium, by the way, is four stars in a lumpy square right in the heart of the Orion gas cloud belts.
And that is a really, really good test for an imager, even if you're using remote telescopes. Now, there's been a Black Projects made a comment that dark energy doesn't exist, and Starstorm has said, but energy is neither created or destroyed.
Well, two different things, but go ahead.
It's good.
Also got kind of a conjunction between Mars and Pluto in Sagittarius. So if you're interested in that, Mars is still out there and getting smaller and smaller, but still there, and Pluto's near there too. You're going to have to, for Northern Hemisphere observers, this is not a good location, really low on the south-southwestern horizon after dark. Not really great for us. Southern Hemisphere gets us a lot higher, much easier to see. By the way, there's a nova in Sagittarius.
Yes, there is.
About
it's
8
just above
magnitude.
The teapot.
It is, right above the spout of the teapot. So you could go to AAVSO, American Association of Variable Stars, and get a finder chart for that nova. So get out and check that out.
Actually, from what I understand, it is a binocular object now.
Yes, it is. Eighth magnitude, so definitely.
Get your binoculars out. Get your tripod out as well. You're going to need it. Because if you ever tried holding 20 by 80s by hand, you know how heavy they get.
So yeah.
Use your tripod, star hop, get and have a good look at it. And, of course, try and image it as well. Because that's always good fun, and it's good practice.
Yep. Actually, any pair of binoculars, if you can get them to be bolted down onto a tripod, you will pick up an extra magnitude, which means basically a one brightness dimmer, just because they're being held steady with any mm-hmm. pair of binoculars. So yeah, find a way of getting your binoculars to mount to a tripod. You'll get a much better view through them, no matter what size binoculars they are.
And of course you can, the nice thing is, yeah. The really nice thing about binoculars is, you can see the Galilean moons of Jupiter. You can actually, there are quite a few deep sky objects you can hunt. Now there's a lovely little program called Tuba, out. It even runs on my Windows 10 machine, which shows you how good it really is. It's freeware. And it is purely there for touring the universe with binoculars. I really heartily recommend getting a copy of that software. It's still out there. It's not supported, so you use it as is.
All right. You started out with binoculars for a good 5 years' worth of astronomical observing, and I was able to see quite a few of the Messier objects with just binoculars. So it's a great way of locating the position of things, and then if you have a telescope, it makes it a lot easier to actually find the objects through a telescope if you already locate them in the sky with a pair of binoculars.
In fact, Aquafew is saying about you must know the exact position. If you get the latest astronomy magazine, Sky and Telescope, Sky at Night magazine, okay. Astronomy Now, they all have inserts in them. They will show you everything you need to know. And you have got a Starstorm has commented about Newton's law of universal gravitation, and Aquafew has actually responded with then came quantum entanglement. You know, this is what our chat room is all about, folks. It's asking us questions, it's putting pieces of information into the chat room, it's taking part, and it is engagement. It is sharing information. And I think this is probably the thing I so love about AFM shows, is because you have a chat room, particularly for the live shows, and you can really get something going. This is what I really like to see.
Definitely. Thanks for the link in our chat room for the Nova and Sagittarius Black Projects.
Yep. It's really good when people start participating. It's not just about me and Marty talking about stuff, about rockets, about travel to other planets, about what if. It is getting the people who are listening to the show to take part and enjoy themselves.
Yes.
And talk about astronomy, quantum mechanics, astrophysics. This is what it's all about, folks.
And we tried to give you the updated news, too, so if, you can hear the latest things that are happening in the sky so that you can get out there and do some observing before they actually disappear. One thing a magazine does not do very well is give you up-to-date information.
That's what we got the internet for, Marty.
Yeah, well, good at detailed articles, but I would say if you just get a subscription, it gets mailed to you. It's good for those monthly star charts. It's good for something that comes around monthly that, you know, gets your interest piqued again, gives you some articles to read on cloudy nights. But unless you actually go to their websites and pick up the actual news from them, you could listen to it from us.
I think, Marty, I'm going to have to start buying some more books on relativity. Starstorm is now posting about Einstein's theory of general relativity in the chat room. This is getting good. I love this.
I'm still reading Richard Green book on other dimensions, something like that. So it's taking me a long time, but I'm getting there, getting into a little bit more detail.
I tell you what, there's a really good book. It's by Leonard Susskind. It's called The Holographic. It's about the holographic universe, and it's a fascinating book. But you're going to need some math for it. It took me 2 months to. It's not a thick book. It's maybe an inch in thickness. It took me 2 months to get through it because I had to sit down, I had to get paper out, and I had to go and physically work through the math.
Uh-huh.
If you can do that, do it. Enjoy it. Have some fun. Learn something. And I think the greatest gift you can give anybody in this day and age is a book. Now, yeah, I know we have Kindles and everything, and they're pretty great for traveling with. But to sit down with a book or to share a book and really get somebody totally enthusiastic. This is getting fun because we've got comments about neutrinos. We got Richard Feynman lectures being posted in there. This is totally and utterly brilliant. All right, this is my daughter, so she's a chip off the old block. She's like her dad. She likes to read science stuff when it suits her. And you know what? If we can only engage other kids like she's become engaged with the whole thing, we would be cracking on. We would be getting the Starship Enterprise physics that we need to explore the galaxy. You know what? I hate to say, I really am happy to say this. This is what we're all about, getting people engaged. And the fact that I have a 17-year-old sitting beside me on her own computer, taking part in the chat room and taking part in physics, the stuff that kids say is boring. People say that STEM is boring. STEM is not boring. It's only boring if you want it to make it that way. Oh, boy, I wish everybody could be reading the chat room right now, because quarks are coming out into this. Oh, man, this is perfect. This is just absolutely perfect.
One thing about learning astronomy I found, though, is it really ruins sci-fi movies, because you start picking apart the bad science. It's like, oh, that's not possible. Oh, that information's wrong. No, but you can neglect a lot of the sci-fi stuff as just sci-fi stuff, but some stuff that's supposed to be real that they make mistakes on, once you learn astronomy and science and stuff like that, you can really pick that apart in movies like that. And sometimes I spend more time on movies picking apart the bad science than I do enjoying the sci-fi.
I think the thing is, though, Marty, just by doing that alone, if the movie has moved you enough to seriously start picking apart the science, then the movie has succeeded, because they have actually got you to engage your mind and think about what they are erroneously saying about the science. So if you're in that position where you're thinking, hang on a minute, no, I know for a fact that you couldn't do that on Mars, it would be more like this. It means they've succeeded in some respects, because you're starting to think science. You're starting to think like a scientist. You're comparing what you know to what they're saying is right, and you're finding the errors. You know what? The greatest thing was, of course, it was Neil deGrasse Tyson. It was Titanic. And he sent James Cameron a letter. He got the sky wrong. You know what? It's great, because when he made the director's cut, he cut the sky right. It's just the fact that people get engaged. They go home from a film thinking, I think that's wrong. I'm going to look it up.
One of the things I always look for is a backwards moon. You'd be surprised when they show a picture of the moon in a movie. A lot of times it's backwards, like film reverse backwards. I don't know why anybody would possibly – how they could possibly do a backwards-shaped moon. And where would they get that image from? I don't know. It's kind of strange.
You know what? Yeah, good point. Nat Geo has got a special coming out of Mars. Thank you, Starstorm.
Welcome.
Set your DVRs. Because I think it's
November 14th,
and they are doing this for serious. They're trying to get the science right for this. They're talking to all the people at ESA, NASA, etc. They're asking the guys in Mission Control how it would be done. How would this work? How would that work? You know what? If they're at least one bunch of people are trying to seriously get people engaged so we go to Mars, support them, show them that it's all been worthwhile.
Yes, indeed. Mars has always been my more favorite planet of the ones out there.
Yeah, you just heard Starstorm. Get them some, give them an award for getting people engaged. That would be perfect.
Well, I hope everybody gets a chance to get out observing this weekend, being new moon, good deep sky weekend. So hopefully have some clear skies, pick up those galaxies, star clusters. Well, mostly this time of the year, star cluster time of the year, especially globular cluster time of the year, because early in the evening we're still pretty much facing towards the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Center of the Milky Way galaxy, so you got a lot more better chance of seeing globular clusters than galaxies. That would get a little later in the evening, after midnight or so, then you'll start picking up more galaxies. Andromeda galaxy is rising, companion to the Milky Way galaxy. Same thing with the Triangulum galaxy, another companion to the Milky Way galaxy. Those are coming up in the early part of the evening too.
Well, Marty, we've done it again, mate. It's getting to that point. We're at 1:49 in the morning. So, and you know what I've got to start saying, don't you? Transporter room on the Miranda. 3 to beam up.
I'm wearing a yellow shirt tonight.
Me too. We're all in yellow shirts.
Don't we say, red shirters. All right, everybody.
Energize.
Time for us to get out of here. Good night. See you next week. My body's dead.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy. Around the world and across the known universe, this is Astronomy.fm Radio.
Hi, this is Tavi Greiner, Astronomy.fm's Vice President of Communications. If you enjoy our programming, please let us know with a donation to astronomy.fm/donate. We really do rely on your support, and it's true, every little bit counts.
AFM. There I was, doing my thing. And all of a sudden, wham! Astronomy right between the eyes.